I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about taking things back. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. We don't know anyone who hasn't wanted to take something back, a gift, an insult, an email. Senior contributor Gina Bereke had the idea to do a call-in show on this. And I don't know about you, but I have a long list of these. Gina Bereke has been on the show from almost the beginning and is a Hartford Current columnist in print and online, the author of many, many books. Gina, welcome back. Start us out with a story.
When I was growing up in Brooklyn, when I was a little girl, and my old Sicilian grandmother had developed skills, life skills, let's call them. I mean, she'd come over on a boat, you know, from Sicily when she was 17 through Ellis Island, and there was not going to be much that was going to get in her way or depress her after all she'd seen in her life. And I had saved up, I think I was six, I had saved up all the money from birthdays. Remember those little cards where people gave you where you got dimes?
Dimes in the slots.
Dimes in the slots. I loved those. I mean, I had a passion for those as a child. So everybody gave them to me.
I don't know them. I've heard about them.
I don't think people do that. Now they have like slots for, you know, $100 bills for kids. But in those days, it was dimes. And I'd saved up to go to a particular toy store on Ocean Avenue that I loved. And I was going to buy, it was a board game like Chutes and Ladders. And I had enough money to buy Chutes and Ladders and chalk. Like, you know, chalk to make hopscotch, like big, those big hunks of chalk.
Fat, yeah.
Yeah. So I was going with my friend Nancy Wallace, and we were walking down the avenue by ourselves, which also shows how long ago it was when two little girls could walk several blocks in Brooklyn alone at six. And somehow I lost the money. And now I'm 57 years old. This is 51 years ago. I remember losing that money like it was a loss in my – I've had many losses in my life. Losing that money that I had saved that had been like the first forward-thinking thing in my child's life, you know, because you don't plan for the future at six. I wasn't thinking about retirement yet. I hadn't invested in anything. But I had somehow – you know, the adults in my life had promised me that if I had been, you know, a careful and good girl and saved my pennies and dimes, I'd be able to go and get myself this thing that otherwise nobody would buy me. It was too trivial, and it was something I'd seen on cartoons on TV. Nobody was going to buy that for me. I had to save the money. And so it was really planning for the future. And then that whole future was lost in, you know, a hole in my pocket, or I was holding Nancy's hand and dropped the $5 bill and the penny and the dimes, whatever it was. I was inconsolable, absolutely inconsolable. So my first point about this is that if I could go back and give myself that money as a child, that is like one of the things I would give. It sounds like such a trivial thing, but it was such a sense of profound loss and the unfairness of life, because I had worked so hard to save up for this. And then it was just gone. And I hadn't been bad. I'd just been careless. But then the funny part was I went home to my grandmother and I said, "Grandma, I lost the money." She said, "Gina, thank God you lost that money." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "You know, you would have bought that game, and then you and Nancy would have been crossing the street, and you would have been so involved in talking about the game that a truck would have run you. Thank God, your guardian angel. When something like that happens, that's because your guardian angel said, don't let her get that. She would have you would have drawn on the sidewalk, and a car would have come up on that sidewalk when you were playing hopscotch, and you would have died at six, your whole life ahead of you. Now, you're a beautiful girl, your whole life ahead of you, and thank God you didn't get that. They took the chalk money, so you didn't die." And I was like, that's one way to look at it. You know, I really wanted that game. But my grandmother had so convinced herself, like Candide, not that she knew the book, that we live in the best of all possible worlds, that even if you thought this was a great loss, there was really a benefit.
That is so good. That is such a good story. So what do you wish that you could take back? I'm with Gina Bereke. It's Gina's idea to do this. I think it's a great one. And, you know, this is different. Or at least you were making the case at lunch that this is different from regret. Mm-hmm. And that's subtle. So why is it different?
I said, like, I think that regret owns a lot of property. And this sense of wishing that you had a certain something back is like a you know, a suburban subdivision. I guess when I was thinking about this as a topic, it's the more sort of wistful, interesting part, as opposed to deep regret. Oh my God, I can't believe, you know, it's more like the smaller losses. Although what I am talking about, or what we're talking about, I think, are the moments of the irrevocable. You know, what is that? Could you go back to the 5 minutes before you hit send on that email that went out, you know, that maybe changed your life maybe in a small way, maybe in a larger way. Mm-hmm. But if you could go back and redo that, could you hit rewind? How would things have been different? So I'm not talking about regret as in, you know, something that changed the course of the world's history. But in some way, it was changed the way that the flow of your life happened. And could you go back and undo that?
Right,
What would be different about your life?
Yeah. Well, when I think of one, it's funny that you came with the stalker, because I was just saying to my partner the other day that one of the things that I wish I could take back happened when I was starting out as a newspaper reporter. And so it was a long time ago. And for some reason, I was assigned to cover a theater performance in eastern Connecticut, so somewhere in Tolland County. And I went to the play, and it wasn't so great. It was a local production. It wasn't so great. And I came back, and I did a review with no experience, but I certainly read a million reviews, and I thought, I know what the voice of this is. And I had a great time at their expense. I cannot tell you how much I wish I could take this back. I probably insulted and hurt the feelings of an entire crowd of people doing their best. And there was nothing about this except showing off.
Yeah.
You know, I think I was looking for attention. And I can't tell you, when I think about that I did that, I just can't tell you. I don't even remember the name of the company, because I'd like to go back and say to them, but here's the thing about this. Mm. Sometimes there is no going back. There is no undoing it.
Right.
They've already been embarrassed.
Right.
You know, they've already had hurt feelings. And I thought to myself, well, I said to my partner, what do I do with that?
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I could think to do was to say this on the air, so that if anybody ever is in this situation, don't do it.
Well, No, and that's a wonderful story. And first of all, I mean, you were just starting out. You said you were very young. You didn't know that your words could have that kind of effect. Did you hear from anybody, or you just
realized
it?
Thinking about their feelings.
Right.
I was only thinking about, I think, you know, really, when I think back, do I remember saying, I think I'll show off? No, but I think that was the motivation.
That's in a way the innocence.
You know?
That's the innocence of youth. It's when people do that.
Oh, I think it's ambition and not the good kind.
No, absolutely. But in a way, that's what I mean by innocence. I mean, this is when people you weren't even making a choice to be mean. You were just choosing to, ooh, I'm going to do this like sparkling, witty thing so I sound like I'm from The New Yorker. You weren't thinking about anybody but yourself. There is that kind of innocence of selfishness.
See, it's even worse when I hear you saying it back to me. It's like, thank you. But I deserve every word of what you're saying. Honestly, I just am so mortified that I did that.
But that's like you've been carrying that around for years. I mean, these are the moments.
You know, I wish I could tell you that.
Yeah.
But I shoved that away somewhere in the deep recesses so I wouldn't have to think about it. And I don't know why it came into my head. I know why. Because I was talking about someone I used to know who, you know, had a certain reputation, was doing national magazine articles. And this woman did a story on Liam Neeson and said, a total hatchet job on Liam Neeson after spending a lot of time interviewing him, the actor. And he, I'm sure was devastated, embarrassed. It was in a national, well-known publication. And this person wrote a letter later after feeling terrible about having done this, you know, again, showing off. And no response. Mm. And so, you know, again, one of those things you can't take back.
Right. And especially when something is in print, you know, it's really can follow you for the rest of your life in a way now that it didn't used to be able to. Somebody at least would have had to go to the archives. But what I think that one of the things that impresses me, and this why it's important what you're saying is for everybody to remember, it's rarely our generosity that we regret. Right. It's not when we make somebody else feel better that you go back and say, oh, I wish I had, unless you break up with somebody, then you make it, you know, you can feel bad about your generosity.
One. No, there's another one.
See, one of my favorite lines in life, and this, I don't know if this was my grandmother, but this was one of like the old people in the family was quoting, I'm sure from a book or from, you know, a fortune cookie, but it said, never give replaceable lovers irreplaceable gifts.
Ooh.
And I thought that that was, because that's a regret, right? Everybody has something when you said you give a gift. What are the kind of gifts that you would regret? I think the only gift you would regret giving somebody is something that you gave, usually in a moment of, you know, swooning passion for someone. You know, you gave them your grandmother's ring. You gave them a book that you bought that was a first edition that you can't very well 15 years later go and say, you know, remember that first edition I gave you of, you know, Mark Twain's, da, 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 da. I would really like that now. You know, I just went online and saw how much that was worth. It means nothing to you. You still don't know how to read. Can I please have that book? And, you know, that's, it's when you break up that you want to go back and get that stuff back. And,
though I would begin this part a little bit earlier because that would be among the things that I would like to take back. The way that I broke up with a couple of people, not intentionally unkind. I think more in a panic, you know, that thing where you're kind of fleeing from some situation or something that's going on. And so you're a bit, you know, I think I was reckless or unfeeling about somebody else's feelings. I very much, you know, a couple people wish I had done that better with more grace and more sense of dignity about the person. I really do.
That's an interesting one. I think that...
Left that person with dignity, I mean.
Left that person with dignity, okay. Yeah. That grace, I think that goes back to the generosity. But when we're so much in that moment, you know, like you said, reckless. I mean, recklessness might be something that all of this has in common. It's the thing that you do that's reckless because you're not planning it. It is the spontaneous thing. Again, I've sent emails in a moment when I should have stepped back. And that's what we would wish. This is the moment you would like, right? For the most of the moments that I would, if we're talking about the moments that I'd like to get back, it's the moment that right before I did something reckless, right before I didn't think, you know what, I'll wait a day before I send this email. I'm usually pretty good at waiting the day before sending an email. I don't just hit send. My husband once, in a very funny email, but he was responding to something for the department at UConn when we were both teaching there, and he's since retired, but it has nothing to do with his retirement. But this was before he retired, and he was making fun of some note that someone sent. And instead of just making an ironic comment to one of his friends, he did the hit, you know, send all, reply all. So this sort of snarky comment about this departmental memo went to the entire department. And so his, his payment for this was that he then got a lot of snarky comments and ironic replies back. I mean, it was good natured enough. It wasn't really mean spirited, but he was still being sort of like, ha, 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 look at this. And then everybody else and 35 people in the department wrote back to him because this note from him had appeared in their box. And so, you know, we really do have to be careful about, you know, what we send out there into the world.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know,
I'm so sympathetic. Yeah. On all ends of the spectrum. So what do you wish that you could take back? Gina Borecka is here. We'd love to hear from you if you have a story. 203-776-9677. Easy to remember. 203-776-WNPR. And we'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
What do you wish you could take back? I'm Faith Middleton with Gina Borecka. It's great to have you listening with us. It's a call-in show, and we invite you to tell a story. And Gina, next I'd like to talk with you about playing it too safe, because when we did the little introduction to the show, I said, you know, this works the other way too, that where you can just, you can play things too safe, stay longer than you should, and then wish you could take that back. So hang on with that thought. Chuck, Faith, and Gina, welcome to the show. Go ahead, Chuck.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, am I live now?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
Faith, I'm Chuck. And from Southington, Connecticut, and similar to the story that you talked about in terms of the review that you did a number of years ago, I wrote, co-wrote the first book in the country to deal with deadly fires in prisons and jails, and because of that, wound up flying across the country doing workshops and seminars, and frankly, I did not have at the time any concept of exactly what power there was in that, in having done that. And so I remember distinctly doing a workshop in Savannah, Georgia. And at the end of the workshop, I gave out copies of my book. And someone came up to me and asked if I would sign a copy of the book. Now, I don't know if it was false humility or pride or whatever, but I remember saying to him, you know what? You want a, if you want a signature from somebody, you want somebody important, not me. And he turned, and as he turned and walked away, I caught the expression on his face.
Mm.
And the expression was, gee, thanks a lot. You know, I don't even matter enough to you for a lousy signature. And regardless of whatever the reason was that I said no, I wish I could take that back. Then I've been writing novels only recently, and if someone asked me to sign the bottom of their shoe, I would do it.
Yeah. Oh, Chuck, that's a great example, and I think many people can identify with what you're saying, you know, either with the best of intentions or just an off-the-cuff decision or remark or even pride, as you say. And you know, these are the kinds of daily living things that we wish we could, you know, Groundhog Day, we wish we could do these over. Thank you so much for your story.
Well, thank you for the opportunity of sharing.
Okay, all right.
Could I mention the book that I've currently got out?
Yeah, sure. I'll sign it for you. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it. It's called Amanda's Room. It's a paranormal thriller. And if anybody's interested in it, I think they'll have a good read. And thank you for the opportunity to mention it.
Okay. Bye, Chuck. Thanks a lot.
Now, that's really interesting, because it is, once again, it's that sense, and, you know, credit to Chuck for being able to see it just as it happened, mm-hmm. but that sense where you're thinking just about how something makes you feel, and where you suddenly recognize that it's somebody else is feeling more than you are at the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, you're concerned with, like, how's my position here? And then you see that this affects somebody deeply. And it's really hard. And that's something that I realized that you have to get a balance for that in teaching. Because when you're up there in front of 30 people or 45 people or 90 people or however many are in your class at the time, you're going to say things and people are going to be struck by them in different ways. And so you can't be so diplomatic that nobody gets anything. You can't be so impersonal. So, I mean, I'm teaching English literature. You have to get into the ideas. It's a conversation. But maybe actuarial science is different. You know, it's not so much of a conversation. But there are times, especially when I first started teaching, that I, again, wanted to make such an impression mm-hmm. that I would say inflammatory things, or I would make these declarations when I was all of 26 or 27. And I could see that people, you know, the students who were even younger than I was, were taking them very seriously, as if I were giving them truths about life that were not really debatable. And I would like to go back now and say, I'm sorry, I didn't know anything. I still don't know anything. Nobody knows anything. But what we have to do is discuss it in terms of the book. And this is what happens in the book. And this is how it goes.
Oh, yeah.
And please don't take this as seriously as I was taking myself in 1986.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Ted, hi. Faith Middleton with Gina Borecka. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi, Ted.
I think this was kind of divine intervention that you were talking about this when I got in the car and turned it on, because I've been trying to apologize to somebody for the better part of 20 or 30 years, and I'm not given that opportunity. But back in college, I was really struggling with my own sexuality and coming out, and I treated my hometown roommate who went away to college with me really badly, and kind of dumped her on the doorstep and went to figure out all this other craziness that was going on in my life. And she was an introverted person, is an introverted person, fairly shaky self-esteem, like a lot of us do at that age. And, you know, as I've matured, I felt so horrible about how I did that. And she never really understood why and what was going on in my life. And just actually 6 months ago, I went back to her hometown, and I ran into her, and I gave her my phone number, and I said, please call me. I said, I owe you a huge explanation and an apology. And she didn't call me. So she won't hear this in Ohio, but I'm sorry. And it was, you know.
Yeah. Right. You know, you're so reminding me, Ted, of people who, you know, part of the AA tradition would be to make amends to people you have harmed, but not to do them harm in the process. And that is such, it requires a very delicate and nuanced judgment. And sometimes it can happen, especially for people who are new, you know, I'm told by others in AA, you know, the people who are new in the program can just start, you know, apologizing in the worst possible way for things in the past. And the recipient is not so happy. In your case, I don't mean to compare that. It's hard to know whether to let sleeping dogs, you know, stay where they are, or just, or to open that door again. You know, sometimes it makes somebody more anxious to think, you know, I don't remember that, but I don't want to know anything about this, you know. Anyway, I thank you for your story so much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
And I think that Ted raises a good point that we were talking about, you and I, Faith, were talking about earlier, which is that a lot of people, I believe, and this is not exactly what she was saying, but that you think that you could go back and do your youth again and you would do it so much better, right? Mm-hmm. That we have this fantasy. I mean, even apart from America being a youth-obsessed culture and people thinking, if I had the looks I had at 18, if I had the looks I had, I'm just talking about people thinking, oh, I want to go back to being 18. I want to go back to being 22. I work with a lot of young people, and they're in my office eating candy, you know, and using all the Kleenex. So they're weeping copiously. There's nothing you could offer me. No money, no, you know, jewelry, fame, yachts, that said, you have to go back and be 22 again. Not for anything. It is so hard.
Well,
so,
what are people saying, though, that they want to do? I think we all want to go back. Live it. But wait, there's a caveat. Okay. We want to go back and live it again with the wisdom we have now. I mean, really.
I don't think that I wouldn't do it even with. There's a great Charlie Brown cartoon where Charlie Brown is standing at the wall, and I think it's Linus comes up to, you know, the philosopher with his security blanket and says, Charlie Brown, if you could do the year over again, would you do it? And Charlie Brown says, I mean, exactly the year. As he said, yes. I mean, exactly every day as it was. And then, you know, how Charlie Brown would run screaming with that big, and he runs screaming at the possibility of doing it all over again. But even knowing what I know now, not that, again, it's that much, and knowing what I didn't know then and going back and doing it, no, it would be like being chained to a radiator. I would not be that age, not having the idea of what was going to be ahead and having to make all those decisions and to be so deeply insecure. And that's when, again, the lack of generosity we show towards other people, not in a way to let everybody off the hook, I mean, I think we have to live with those mistakes that we made. But to think that we would somehow do it better now, that, you know, that's also sort of a fiction that we carry around
with
us.
Oh, no.
Except for you. No. You There's would do it much better.
No, I would. Knowing what I know now, oh, I can't tell you. The list is endless of things I would do, things I would do differently, the way I would handle a million situations. And talk about staircase wit. You know, a lot of situations where I would have now the most delicious comeback. For certain situations.
But we started talking about the idea of safety versus the recklessness.
Yeah.
Right?
So meaning, you know, this also works for what you could take back of staying too long in a thing.
Right.
Not leaving too soon.
Or being,
to leaving badly, you know.
To act passively. I mean, contradiction, but to be passive out of a sense of fear. Jim Carrey, I'm not that much of a Jim Carrey fan, but one of my students sent me a clip that he did for somebody's graduation. I don't remember the school this year. And he was talking about how he said his father could have been a great stand-up comic. He said, but his father, I guess, you know, married his mother young and had, you know, four kids, and so decided, you know, not to do that, that he wanted to be safe, and he became an accountant, and that he was going to, you know, be the caretaker of the family, and he was going to make choices, you know, that were good for the family, a good, solid, safe choice for the family. And then after working for the same firm for 16 years or something, got laid off, and that the family became destitute, and his father was out of work and couldn't find another job because he'd been at this place for so long. And so Jim Carrey said, what I realized from that was you could act to be safe and to be secure, and you could fail at that. So you might as well fail at your dreams. Then, you know, think big. Act, do exactly what you want. So at least if you fail, you're going to fail at something that you love and something that you want to do, as opposed to thinking that just because you're acting to be safe, that that means, you know, you really will be safe.
Ah, Gina, when do you decide to do that? I just the other day had a great guy. We're talking about different things. And I said, well, you have to be, you know, consider your family and, before you make whatever decision you're going to make. And he said, he said, but I want to take a shot. I want to get a shot at this. And I thought, what a tough decision to make, because people, you know, in families, we rely on each other.
Right.
And you do have a responsibility on the one hand, and on the other, they have one to you about what you're talking about.
Right.
It's very hard.
It's the idea of at a certain point, I talk about this in my classes, that at a certain point where what you think of as a safety net, right? We want to create a safety net, but the safety net, if it pulls too close, becomes a noose, right? It becomes nothing that's safe. It becomes the thing that's going to kill you. It becomes incredibly dangerous. It becomes the thing that you get tangled up in, and it means that you can't move. And that's terrifying. And so that if I look back on something that if there was any amount of time I would take back, it was a time when I was living in England, and all I wanted we talked about it when we were doing the Seven Deadly Sins about sloth. And it was a time in my life where I felt like if I just kept myself under the radar, didn't do anything, was a good girl, didn't make waves, cooked in a hot pot, tried to make entire meals in a hot pot to be like where Laura Ashley dresses and straighten my hair, that I could somehow get away with avoiding the responsibility for living my own life. And I guess, you know, again, in some ways, I don't regret it entirely, but I regret that it took as long as it did for me to get out of it. But I'm just grateful that it didn't take my whole life, which, you know, I think I would have welcomed the chance to stay in that quote unquote safe space that would have killed me.
Gina Breck is here. What do you wish you could take back? 203-776-9677. Pete, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot for having me. I really appreciate it. What a great topic today. I'm going to get, like, the horns from every single woman listening to this show today, but how are you going to tell it anyway? Because it's part of growing up, right?
Yeah.
So my first wife and I, 23 years ago, were young, and we used to argue with each other a lot, and we would insult each other like we thought it was fun, which back then I didn't realize that insulting somebody that you're married to on a regular basis is just like dropping acid on the floor. It just burns holes through your marriage. So one evening, I'm reading the newspaper, and I see a young lady who got married. It's a girl I used to date, and I said, geez, look, so-and-so's in the paper. She got married. And my ex-wife said, oh, she doesn't look good in that dress. She looks horrible. I can't believe she got married in it. And I emphatically stuck both feet in my mouth and both fingers in my head. And I said, well, she looked better in her wedding dress than you did.
Oh.
24, 23 years ago. We were only married 3 years. But it was such a back and forth that we insulted each other constantly like it was a game. It was almost entertaining to see who could insult the other more. And I don't even understand to this day why we did it. I don't even know how we got caught up in that. But to this day, it just, I said I'm sorry 150 times that week, that month, that year. It doesn't make a difference. It's not something you can ever, 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 ever take back. And it was youthfulness and stupidity and lack of respect for somebody. And no matter how many things I label it, there's no way to take it back. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I can say is that I learned from it. I've been married 19 years to the same woman. I was the best man at her first wedding, had nothing to do with their marriage falling apart. We don't insult each other on a regular basis. We don't treat each other like that. And I chalk it up to the experiences from that first marriage. I try not to make those mistakes that caused that marriage to fail. Mm-hmm. And I think we're both equally at fault for it. But when you say, would you like to take something back? That's probably the top of my, not probably, it's definitely at the top of my list of things that I should have never have done and that I've tried to learn from and that I try to implore to other young guys when they're talking to their girlfriends and they're disrespectful to them and saying, listen, you're going to say something someday that no matter how many times you say you're sorry, you cannot make it.
Can't undo. Yeah, well.
It's brutal. And I can hear women screaming at the radio about me right now. Listen, I get it. I know I was wrong. You don't have to tell me. I'm owning up to it. But, man, was it be right before you're about to engage your mouth and engage your brain first, because there are some things in life you know. You could go to your priest. You could go down to the rabbi. It doesn't make a difference. Once it's said, it cannot. You can apologize. You can try to forget it, but it cannot be undone.
Mm. Pete, thank you so much for your candor. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Well, to Gina Bereke for coming up with this idea for a call-in show. This gets to the person who doesn't have a censor. And so I want to talk about that on the other side of this break. We're going to take a quick break and then back with Gina Bereke to talk about what do you wish you could take back? Call us. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. I wanted to let you know that I am serving as honorary chair on Saturday for the Pomperog River Watershed Organization or Association's event in Woodbury, Connecticut. And if you go online, you can find out more about that. Hope to see you there. That's at WNPR.org. Search programs for the Faith Middleton Show. Gina Bereke is here in... we're asking you, what do you wish you could take back? We certainly have long lists. Gina, as I hear people talking about this and as we talk about our things, I wonder if this is, what it feels like to be a priest in the Catholic Church as people come into the confessional, kneel down in a position of supplication and humiliation and say, I did the following things. And then the priest is in a position to say, after some questions usually, well, here is your penance, quote-unquote penance. It's an interesting idea, isn't it?
Right, and the te absolvo, right? I mean, I absolve you of the sin. And it's the idea of giving penance is, wouldn't it be nice if Again, the guy who said that she looks better in you than mm-hmm. you did in your wedding dress, which, yes, would be like that kind of remark is like a tattoo that's right into your skin. The ink goes deep. That would be very hard to remove no matter how much. But if you could just say, okay, these are the 16 things you need to do. You have 12 Hail Marys and 4 Our Fathers and, you know, you need to be in a cold bath for 4 hours or something. And that then that would actually get rid of it. I mean, mm-hmm. how spiritually convenient if that were only the case. And if we could actually say that to somebody. I mean, I would love to be able to say to somebody who hurt me, if you just did these 3 things, like in a fairy tale, right? I mean, that's what often happens in a fairy tale. That is what we're looking for in our most childish, basic hearts is here are the things I need to do, you know, to get you to forgive me, to be a winner, to, you know, be princess. And so that if you could just say it takes these things, I mean, we would all do it. We would all want to be forgiven. But it's interesting to hear the stories that people carry with them. I mean, we carry these things like, you know, heavy weights that are in a sack on our back. And
the doer and the doee.
Right. Yes. Both of us. Right. All of us. Yep. Yep, we participate in this dance that's somehow still going on. The music is still there in the back of our heads.
Grace Faith Middleton with Junior Barreca, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, Grace.
Hi. 45 years ago, I was pregnant and I wasn't married. And that was a terrible shame back then. And my family said, we love you, but you have to go away because we can't let anyone find out about this. And the plan was to send me to Kentucky to stay with my aunt, for whom I named. She's my father's older sister, and they were always very close. Mm. And I had visited her a couple of times prior to that, and I knew she was a teacher, well-loved in the community. She was an elder in the Presbyterian Church. And I knew I couldn't go there because I felt that she would be embarrassed by me being there in my condition and ashamed of me. And I refused to go. And my parents sent me to Atlanta instead. My sister-in-law found a place there for me to go. But I was 20 years old then. And I didn't know that if a person was truly religious, as my aunt was, mm-hmm. she would have loved me and accepted me. And I would have had the opportunity to spend time with her that obviously I never, ever had again because I grew up in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And she lived away the whole time I knew her. And it would have been kind of a bonding opportunity, and I refused it because I was afraid of, I don't think, now I know mm-hmm. she would not have rejected me. She would have welcomed me with open arms.
Mm, so you're saying you wish in hindsight that, you know, how does one at such a young age have the wisdom? You know, it's what I think. You know, how does someone at that age and in the situation you were in, considering, you know, that you were living in the midst of a shunning society, the opposite of what someone would need in your situation, you know, how do you have the wisdom to know what you're supposed to do, huh?
I didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again,
not.
You wouldn't have assumed generosity. I mean, you were afraid, and so you were acting out of fear. And I'm sure that your aunt, if she was that loving, could also have understood how you were feeling.
Mm. I'm sure she would have now. You know, looking back.
Yeah.
On my life, and I mean, this happened many years ago. She's long gone, and I've grown up. I've grown older. I eventually got married and had more children. But I never forgot that situation. It happened. Mm-hmm. It was a very low time in my life. I had flunked out of college. I was ashamed to even go home after that because I come from a family of all college graduates, and here I was.
Yeah. You know, it makes me appreciate anew that, you know, these are the kinds of trials on the journeys we're on that forge our character, and the idea that you know and appreciate the subtlety of what happened there is quite admirable. Thank you so much, Grace.
Thank you for listening to me.
You're welcome. Well named.
Thank you, Grace.
Well named, Grace.
Thank you. I'll try to live up to it.
Okay, 203-776-9677 here on the show. Gina Breck is here, and we're talking about, she brought this idea to the show. I just love it. You know, what do you wish you could take back? We have long lists, and perhaps you do too. I don't know how you get through this life without having one. Gina.
One of the things that, again, we were talking about was the idea of language being such an important part of this. What you could say, what would make, is there stuff that you could actually go back and say to somebody that would make a difference? Or are words, once they're out of your mouth? I mean, one of the things that I believe is that once you say to somebody, we're just friends, you know, we're just friends, aren't we? You have that conversation. You're not just friends, because people who are just friends don't have that conversation. And that, you know, I try to help the students understand that if, you know, you're talking about how much you're just friends, that that ship has already sailed. You know, again, I don't go to my dentist and go, you're just my dentist, right? We don't reestablish this, you know? I mean, you only have that conversation when there's a little bit of doubt as to whether or not you are. So that once you launch those sorts of words out there, they swirl around, you know, like molecules that are now part of the universe and become something else. So that it doesn't mean, when you're talking about people who don't have sensors, that was one of the things that we were talking about, is that when people keep launching, you know, it's like those machines that throw baseballs out that people are supposed to hit, that if you're in conversation with people who just keep launching those ideas out, sometimes, you know, you're at their mercy and you don't know what they really mean and what they don't mean. And right when you have those conversations with people, so, you know, they will say whatever comes into their minds, and it's very difficult to figure out what out of that you need to take seriously and not seriously.
Mm-hmm. Lauren, Faith Middleton with Gina Barreca. Go ahead, Lauren.
Hi. I'm going back to the topic of regretting inaction or passivity, and those are some of the biggest regrets in my life. And it's not only missing seized opportunities, or, you know, not seizing opportunities, but also not having those difficult conversations with people you love, I think, are some of my biggest regrets. You know, one recent example is someone who I love dearly and who I'm close enough with to have a conversation has posted certain things on Facebook that make people uncomfortable or that make her vulnerable for attacks, and she doesn't see that. And enough time has passed since those posts that it's awkward for me to have that conversation with her now, and I wish I had had it at the right time.
Yeah, I think you're in a long line, my friend.
But do you think, you don't think that, I always feel like when people say, well, I didn't do it when I should have done it, but doing it now, at least you get to do it. You don't feel like it's worth having the conversation, even if it might be a little bit late?
True. And for that example, it probably isn't too late. It's not the best time, but it's not too late.
And the
times when it is too late is when the person is no longer in your life.
Right. And I think just to know, because you're going to have to be the one that we're talking about carrying that stuff with you. You're going to carry the idea that you didn't say something that you might have been able to say. I mean, the most you would risk is seeming like a fool or seeming overbearing, where you're feeling if she's really at a different kind of risk, it seems to me that it might be worth saying something. Sometimes we trust the people around us in a way to provide that kind of mirror to ourselves that we can offer, you know, in our own lives, you know, if we're just looking at ourselves. So just, you know, maybe you want to just say it and say, at least you did your bit.
And bear in mind, we don't know what we're talking
about. Exactly.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Lauren.
Hi.
At least I will say that about myself.
Absolutely.
But I was thinking, so here's this, something struck me when you brought this topic, Gina, because I thought, how interesting that our law publishes premeditated murder so much more severely than a crime of passion. You know, so you know, people do something, take an action, and there's a horrible result. Mm-hmm. If you've thought about it ahead of time and did it on purpose,
right?
Bad, according to the law. But if it is something just happens from, say, some kind of argument or whatever it might be, some inflamed reaction,
right.
not punished as severely.
And right, and doesn't remorse come into that, right? They want evidence of remorse so that you wish you could go back and undo what you did, I think is something that the judge at least takes into account in terms of sentencing. And so that we're looking for how, again, like you said, how deliberate this moment is in your life, but so much of our lives mm-hmm. is, you know, like losing that money on the street. You don't know when it's going to happen.
And of course, you think about the family members of these and friends of people who are either dead or have been hurt in some profound way, getting their chance in front of the court to say to the perpetrator, the alleged perpetrator, you might be sorry, but that's not going to bring back
right.
X or... Right. Or reestablish this person's innocence, or, you know, you've stolen the childhood from my beloved friend. And, you know, I mean, on and on it goes. It's really something.
Yeah.
The remorse sometimes isn't enough. So in comes responsibility.
Right.
You know, the worst things can happen inadvertently, and yet you are still responsible to society for what you have done.
Mm-hmm.
Cynthia, Faith Middleton with Gina Baraka.
Hi, Faith and Gina. This is really interesting because I haven't thought of this incident since, I don't know, a couple of decades. And as soon as you asked about it, it came to my mind. I grew up in a family of six kids, and my mother left our family when I was two. So she was not the mother who raised me. My stepmother was. And I was reunited with my biological mother when I was 19. For a few years, and we gathered every once in a while, kind of got to know her a little, but really she didn't stay in my life. And we parted ways on my doing. I was okay with not having her in my life. I felt like she gave me life, and that's all she was really to me. I really couldn't find any connection with her. And so I found out she was dying when I was in my, I think, early 30s, and I had the opportunity to go and see her for her last few weeks, but I chose not to, and it was a very conscious decision. I felt like I didn't need to. I didn't need to carry the weight. I didn't need to reunite,
mm-hmm.
and all I was thinking about was me, and now that I'm 50-something, I think... What I wish I could take back was the ability to give her the gift of just seeing her again, just for her sake, not so much for mine, but for hers. And sometimes we have to do things that are not comfortable or difficult or something just we're not even interested in for the benefit of someone else. And
Yeah, Cynthia. And also, I think it's important to add the possibility that, I mean, we know this, death makes us afraid. And when people are dying, they talk about this a lot. Nancy Horn, the psychologist, has talked about this on the air, that people can distance themselves from you when you're dying because of unconscious fear. It's scary. And, you know, who knows, maybe this is involved in this decision of yours, too. Thank you so much for calling the show and saying what you said. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Gina? That's really hard. That's really, the stories that people told today were very brave. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of courage. And I hope that it in hearing themselves tell the stories, that was also a sense of gathering up what happened to them and putting it in place, which is what it seems to me part of this is about.
Yeah, I guess in the end, this idea of trying, you know, when people have done really horrific things and then started their lives over again. You know, all you can do is
try
and learn from these things.
And even if it's not even that horrific, it's just a small blip that you could go back and you say, I'm going to re-knit that part. I'm going to at least tell the story about it, and it'll be new.
Yeah, how to build moral character. Thank you, Gina Borecka. Just a terrific idea. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, great recipes, great guests like Gina, and value wines that we feature right now online at WNPR.org. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.